Hello and welcome to Beyond Reproach. This is Stephanie Domingo.
And Tux Lerzel.
I come to you from North Canton, Ohio, where I'm recording on land belonging to the Kaskaskia Nation.
So I come to you from Detroit, Michigan, where I record on land belonging to the Ojibwe, Ottawa, Wyandot, and Potawatomi Nations.
Yes, all of these nations are some of many still very much out here doing their thing, and we would like to acknowledge that. This is the show about scandals. Yes, heck yes. Scandals and scandalousness in American politics and government. We be drinking and we be swearing.
As per usual.
Yes.
The ways in which.
When you think about the ways in which.
So today we're drinking a cocktail called a Golden Cadillac. This is another sweet cream-based cocktail made with white creme de cacao, similar to the pink squirrel that we had last season. Instead of the creme de noyau, though, the Golden Cadillac, which is also sometimes just called a gold Cadillac, calls for Galliano, which is a sweet Italian liqueur flavored with anise, herbs, and vanilla. The Golden Cadillac was invented at a roadside bar and barbecue in El Dorado, California, called Poor Red's Barbecue. According to Poor Red's website, they invented the cocktail in 1952 when a newly engaged couple came in to celebrate their engagement. The couple asked the bartender, Frank Klein, to create a special cocktail just for them that would match their brand new gold-colored Cadillac parked outside. Which is a weird fucking bold thing to do, to go up to a bartender that you don't know. Like, make me a brand new drink that doesn't exist just for me.
That matches my tacky car, please.
I know. So weird. But so the bartender tried a few things and eventually decided on this sweet, creamy cocktail shaken until frothy.
He decided to serve.
I mean, mine is sort of goldish because it's got the Galliano and the cream. Stephanie couldn't find Galliano, so she used.
I used Sambuca.
Which is also sweet and anisey, but doesn't have the same herbal vanilla notes, but it'll be fine. I'm sure it'll taste pretty similar.
Yeah, it's close enough. And my cocktail just looks like milk.
Yeah.
And it's disturbing.
What is it? Sambuca is just clear, but Galliano is yellow. So it does sort of have a gold-ish, eggnoggy kind of color to it.
Okay.
So he decided to serve the cocktail in two different glasses. A champagne coupe glass to signify its celebratory nature for her, and a more manly and masculine sidecar glass for him. So, I know. Give me a break. A man can't drink out of a coupe glass?
No, that on his wedding day, that's going to make a day.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, to this day, when you order a Golden Cadillac at Poor Red's, they serve it to you in two glasses. When you order one drink, you get two glasses. One, you know, a coupe glass and a sidecar glass.
Weird.
Yeah.
You get two cocktails?
I guess. But maybe they're really small glasses, so it only equals one cocktail. I don't really know.
Okay.
But so Poor Red's became famous for this drink throughout the 1950s, and eventually Galliano noticed how high sales had climbed in Northern California and decided to figure out what was going on. I mentioned before when we did the Harvey Wallbanger episode how thirsty Galliano was for easy-to-make, marketable cocktails.
Oh, my God. I love Italian brands like this. They're just like, oh, my God, Americans are eating this shit up. Like, I feel like Americans are the ultimate consumer. Like, once something blows up here, the person can just retire.
Seriously, yeah. So Galliano ran an advertising campaign with a Golden Cadillac recipe from 1964 to 1967, and the drink became famous around the world. This cocktail made Poor Red's the largest single purchaser of Galliano liqueur in the world. And to this day, they serve more Galliano than any restaurant chain, liquor store, hotel chain, or cruise line in existence.
Wow.
I was reading this on their website. It said most bars will have a bottle of Galliano sit on the shelf for years. Because when the fuck are you ever ordering Galliano?
Never. And it's big as hell, too.
Yeah.
Like the bottle.
I actually have a small bottle. I was able to find a smaller bottle. Yeah.
Okay.
But at Poor Red's, the average lifespan of the big bottle, the 750 of Galliano, is only an hour and a half. They go through a 750 milliliter bottle of Galliano every hour and a half.
Oh, my God.
I know. Whoa. So, side
note. Is
that
all they're serving at this bar? I'm so curious.
I guess people just go there just for that. I don't know. Side note, if you're not a dairy fan, you can still drink a Golden Cadillac. In the 1970s, a bar in the East Village started selling them made with coconut cream instead of heavy cream. And their version became so popular that many recipes online call for coconut cream. Mm. Like when you just search Golden Cadillac, it comes up with coconut cream as the ingredient. So yeah, today mine is in a coupe glass, not two separate glasses, because no one else was doing that but poor Reds. The cocktail spread all over the country, all over the world, but no one was serving it in two glasses but poor Reds. And my story today actually takes place in the birthplace of the Cadillac, Detroit, Michigan, in 1967, when Galliano's marketing campaign was at its peak. So, okay. Cheers. Cool.
When I was a kid at school, learning the golden rule, teacher often used to say, if you don't tell a lie, there's not a reason why you can't be like Washington someday. How could Washington be a married man and never, never tell a lie?
Sip here.
Let's see. Ugh, looks so unappealing. Okay. It's delicious.
Yeah.
It's sweet.
Yeah. It is very sweet. You can taste the cocoa a little bit, but you taste the anise first and foremost.
Yeah, that's what I taste. It tastes like dessert.
Yeah. I mean,
I can taste the chocolate, but it's more of like an aftertaste.
Yeah. It's tasty. I don't think I could drink more than one of these because it's like filled with heavy cream and it's very sweet. I can see why they were popular, especially in the 50s and 60s. But I think that I liked the pink squirrel better.
Same.
But it's good. I don't dislike it.
Yeah. Yeah. This is part two, everyone.
Oh, yeah.
Of everyone's favorite topic.
Yeah. So... a few weeks ago, I talked about redlining and how it affected cities across the nation. And I focused specifically on the city that I now call home, Detroit, Michigan. As promised, today I am revisiting Detroit to talk about what happened next, after redlining had really taken effect. Some people call the summer of 1967 the summer of love because of the hippie subculture and the free love movement. But others call the same summer the long, hot summer of 67, not just because of the lingering heat wave that was affecting much of the country, but also because there was civil unrest that seemed to be plaguing the nation that summer. Thousands of young people had taken to the streets to protest the Vietnam War, and in Black communities in hundreds of cities across the nation, there were uprisings against racist, abusive police forces. But Detroit was seen to be a model city for the nation because of its progressive young mayor, Jerome Kavanaugh, who promised to invest in improving conditions in Detroit's Black neighborhoods and to reform and diversify the police department. As the long, hot summer of 67 wore on and confrontations between Black communities and white police forces continued, the leadership of Detroit thought that they had found the key to keeping the peace. But then on July 23rd, around 4 a.m., the city of Detroit erupted in the largest uprising this country had seen since the New York draft riots of 1863. Looters prowled the streets, arsonists set fire to buildings, and civilian snipers took position from rooftops. And police arrested, beat, and shot at citizens indiscriminately. At the end of 5 days of unrest, over 2,500 buildings were destroyed. More than 7,200 people had been arrested, almost 1,200 were injured, and 43 people were dead.
Wow.
So I would like to propose a toast. Raise a glass to the knowledge that words have meaning. Today, I'm going to be trying to avoid using the word riot unless it's in a direct quote. The word riot puts the blame on the people involved and makes them sound like villains rather than victims. Instead, using the terms rebellion or uprising places emphasis both on the political nature of these events and their function as resistance to oppressive law enforcement and racist institutions. Cheers.
Hear, hear.
It's growing on me.
It's not
I still
bad.
Don't think I can. Yeah, I couldn't have another one, but it's good.
Yeah, I wouldn't. I wouldn't order this, but it's not. I was expecting so much worse.
Yeah, yeah. I actually really did kind of like the pink squirrel. Like, if I went somewhere that served pink squirrels, I might order one.
What was I don't in think the pink I would ever squirrel order this. Again?
That creme de noyau. It was like almondy sort
almond,
of, and like
yes.
fruity, like cherry flavored or something.
Yeah. I think we had two of those, didn't we?
Yeah, I think we did. It was pretty tasty.
Yeah, despite the way that it looked.
Yeah. I mean, I liked the look of that better than the look of this. It's this weird sort of like neon eggnog color. So I originally got the idea to do this story one day when I was walking my dogs in my new neighborhood. Just about half a block from my house, the street that my house is on, meets Rosa Parks Boulevard, which is this sort of seemingly unnecessarily wide street with three lanes in each direction. And in the spring, there's a median in the middle that explodes with like flowering trees and daffodils. It's really pretty, but on either side of this really wide street, there's kind of this notable absence of any original architecture. On one side, there's a row of newer low-income townhouses. And on the other side, there's basically nothing there but some huge grassy empty lots and a couple of bus stops. And while, you know, unfortunately, vacant lots are not really that unusual around here, it seemed odd that not a single original structure, other than maybe a couple of churches, still stand on Rosa Parks. So I kind of had just assumed when we moved here that, you know, that street, just like my own, had originally been lined with duplexes, but they were eventually torn down after years of abandonment and neglect. That's, you know, that's kind of common around here, unfortunately. But while I was walking my dogs one day, I stopped to read a historical marker a few blocks away and learned that I had it all wrong. As it turns out, the uprising that would forever change the course of history in Detroit in 1967 began just 2.5 blocks from my house.
Oh, wow.
Before Rosa Parks Boulevard was named after the civil rights hero who used to live about a mile from here, the street was called 12th Street. And back then, it was much narrower, didn't have a median, and rather than being lined with duplexes like I thought, it had actually been a thriving, walkable shopping district that looked a lot like the dense Brooklyn neighborhood that I just left. Before I get into the details of what happened in that summer of 67, though, first I want to talk about why it happened. Despite being hailed as a quote-unquote model city by media pundits and politicians for the progressive politics of the young white mayor here, in the 1960s, Black Detroiters suffered from much of the same discrimination and poor conditions that Black people did in the rest of the country. Inequities in housing, jobs, and education were rampant, as were instances of police brutality. And in the scramble to assign blame in the wake of all these uprisings during the long hot summer of 67, the whole country was trying to understand what was happening and why. I mean, if they opened their fucking eyes, it shouldn't have been that hard to figure out.
I love just the media falling over itself not to find the answer to their question.
You know? Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I love it. I definitely feel that with the midterm right now. And it's just like, what happened?
With the what?
And it's like with the midterm.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It seems like they're refusing to learn just the reality that most of us live in, that we're scared about fascism and
because people don't want to have their bodily autonomy taken away from them.
Yeah.
Crazy concept.
Crazy. I mean, white women are okay with that in mass, but everyone else is just like, bitch, what? The media won't. It's really funny how they scramble out of the way of like truth.
Yeah, exactly. So the Johnson administration established the Kerner Commission to investigate the causes of these civil disorders. Johnson himself was quick to blame Black Power radicals for stirring discontent in Black communities.
Yes.
But to the surprise of most of white America, the commission placed responsibility on racial segregation and discrimination in housing, education, unemployment, and law enforcement.
Okay.
So
it was opposite day.
Yeah.
That commission came out.
So an Urban League survey of Black Detroiters echoed the same findings as the Kerner Commission, revealing that police brutality was the number one cause of the uprising in Detroit. Big fucking shock. Followed closely by crowded and substandard housing and poverty and unemployment. The Kerner report stated, quote, "To some Negroes, police have come to symbolize white power, white racism, and white repression." And it continued, quote, "What white Americans have never fully understood, but what the Negro can never forget, is that white society is deeply implicated in the ghetto. White institutions created it, white institutions maintain it, and white society condones it."
Absolutely.
I'm like,
wow, they like actually took notes on what they were being told.
Yeah.
Oh my God, they did real research.
Like spitting truth over here. I know.
Yeah.
Like, wait, you talked to a Black person?
They were all fired after this report, you know.
I know, right? Yeah, yeah. Johnson's like, no, it was the radicals.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, people were shook when this came out. So despite the white liberal mayor's promise to reform and diversify the DPD, in 1967, the force was 93% white in a city that was 30% Black. The 100 or so Black officers on a force of 5,500 knew enough to watch their backs when it came to their white coworkers. Isaiah Ike McKinnon, who later became police chief and deputy mayor, was on duty during the uprising. And after a long day of patrolling the burning city, he was pulled over on his way home by two white police officers. So despite still being in uniform, he almost didn't live through the encounter.
Pulled me over with their guns drawn. And I said, "Police officer," and smiling as I am, I said, "Police officer." I had my badge. I stepped out of the car. The older officer with his gun drawn, he said, "Tonight you're going to die, nigger."
This is a cop.
This is a police officer.
Telling another police officer,
yes,
"I'm going to kill you."
That's right. He said, "Tonight you're going to die, nigger." I see his finger pulling the trigger. And as I dove back into my car, he started shooting at me. I hit the accelerator with my right hand, the steering wheel with my left hand, and I drove off as he was shooting at me.
What did that tell you?
If a person is of that mindset to me, a fellow officer, what the hell is he going to do to the rest of the people in our city?
He's going to do what he's been doing this whole time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Terrorize ethnic populations.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, that's what the police was like created to do, you know?
Yeah.
The police force.
I guess as a police officer, he didn't want to believe that.
He'd
seen it for himself before.
Yeah,
before this, he talked about how he was beat up by cops when he was a kid.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
I don't know.
It's not going to change. You're not one of them ever. Like, that's, it's such a fucked up situation, system. And there are people who get into it, people of color, all sorts of people of color who get in and they think that they can change a system that is fundamentally corrupt.
It ends up changing
them.
And they
can't. It is impossible. It has to be completely burned down and reorged. And there's no way to just reform it. Like, come on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unless you're going to let all of them go and hire a completely new force and have completely.
And like a fraction of them, and then just have some of the work done by social workers. And, you know, there's no reason to have the bloated police department that we have today in this country.
No.
Yeah. So,
it's very lucrative to have the police force. Like
we got them tax dollars. Yeah.
So that's why they still exist. It's a jobs program for white supremacists. Anyways.
Yeah. So after two of Detroit's biggest and oldest Black neighborhoods, Black Bottom and Paradise Valley, were bulldozed to build highways, like I mentioned in the last episode, the two-family duplexes that surrounded 12th Street filled up with more and more families than they were ever meant to hold. Greedy landlords divided and then subdivided the once spacious flats and the shops over 12th Street to squeeze in as many people as possible, with little thought about comfort, health, or safety. Yeah. By 1967, the neighborhood had the highest population density in the entire city. And thanks in part to the new highways, the city had lost almost 150,000 jobs to the suburbs in the years after World
War
II.
Wow,
that's 150,000 jobs.
So many jobs.
Yeah. Because all the, you know, they'd also lost a lot of people to the suburbs, but like,
yeah,
unemployment among Black men was more than double that of white men in Detroit.
Yeah.
And young Black men were especially affected because of strong unions and seniority in the remaining factories that were still here. Older Black men had jobs that they'd had for a long time, and younger guys couldn't find work. Mm-hmm. So it should be no surprise that the typical looter during the uprising was an unemployed Black male between 15 and 24 years old. Just young guys.
Yeah. Yeah. Who have nothing else to do because the system won't allow them to have legitimate work. Yeah.
Exactly. Nothing to lose and no fucking money. So if people are breaking windows and jumping into stores to take a fucking TV, of course they're going to jump in and do it too. They have I also read that I took this out of my outline, but here I am putting it back in, that there was there was a direct correlation between the length of unemployment and their likelihood to be involved in the uprising.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People who had been unemployed for more than a year were way more likely to do this than people who had only been employed for a short time.
People aren't just robbing to rob. Like, these are crimes of desperation.
Exactly. Yeah,
it's trash.
Yeah. So while most of the businesses along 12th Street were still Jewish owned, they catered almost exclusively to Black customers. And that caused a lot of tension between these Black customers and the white and Jewish shop owners, who welcomed them with rudeness, disrespect, unethical credit practices, and price gouging. Mm. In the 1 mile long strip of storefronts on 12th Street, there were 22 bars and 15 liquor stores. The area became famous for petty theft, drugs, gambling, and prostitution. And locals called the area the Sin Strip, the Avenue of Fun, or the Pocket Ghetto. Mm. One local said, there was a daytime 12th Street and there was a nighttime 12th Street, and they didn't overlap. During the day, the good citizens came out, like your mother. All the hustlers that were there knew that your mother wasn't into that stuff, so she just came shopping. But come dark, mama goes home and gets off the street, and the night shift comes on. So while this uprising came as a shock to the white leadership and residents of Detroit, civil rights organizations and Black leaders had been predicting a major racial disturbance in Detroit for years. In the fall of 1965, the Michigan Civil Rights Commission conducted a study of the so-called Watts riots in LA, with the specific goal of preventing a similar event in Detroit. The report warned that Detroit had the same problems as the Watts area, with thousands of Black residents.
Oh my God, it's like it's systemic or something.
I know, unbelievable.
What? The same problems in a different city?
I mean, how could that even happen?
I know,
What a coinky dink.
What a coinky dink indeed. Oh my God. So, you know, they said quinky dinks. Reports,
absolutely. Yeah, this report said that there were thousands of Black residents living in, quote, abject poverty, exploited by merchants and property owners with little hope of improving their or their children's lot.
Yeah.
But The city's leadership thought that Detroit was doing all the right things, and what was happening in the rest of the country could never happen here. But of course, it could, and it did. I mean, they really thought that the leadership of the city was doing the right thing because they had this liberal mayor that was investing money into
Black neighborhoods. Oh my God, the liberal mayors are the...
I know. They were getting all this money from Johnson's Great Society Initiative, and they were like investing, but then the poor Black Detroiters were saying that it was only benefiting
were they really wealthy investing Black Detroiters. Though?
They were, but they were investing in like... They were investing in like Black owned businesses and stuff. So the only people that were really benefiting were Black people who also already had a little bit of money. So the poor people were like, you're not helping us. You're helping people who are already doing fine.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of animosity between Black people with money in Detroit and Black people who didn't have money in Detroit. And I'll get into that in a little bit.
Yeah, that's every ethnic group, though. There is a class thing happening. Yeah,
totally. Yeah, I mean, that's the story of this country, too. This whole country, as much as it's very much racially based, there's this the classism in this country is... Yeah, absolutely. 100%. Yeah. But yeah, so those are the sort of reasons why the uprising happened. Mm-hmm. Before I get into the actual uprising and what happened on that in those 5 days, I'm going to need another drink.
Yikes, same.
I don't know if I'm going to make another one of these, though.
It ain't going to be this one.
Yeah, I think I'm just going to switch to some whiskey. This is good, but it's I couldn't do it.
I couldn't possibly. It's like very sweet. I mean, it's not bad, you guys, and it's not hard to make. Don't buy these things.
It's super
if you don't
easy.
Have them already, but it is
Galliano is expensive and
Yeah.
It's fine, but the cream is also too much for me. The sugar in the cream, it's like I don't need two of these. So it's whiskey it is. Yes. We'll be right back. After these messages.
So, have you ever thought about what would happen if your airline window popped out? Or if you could build a jetpack using only machine guns? Well, turns out you could, but you really shouldn't. Hi, I'm Jill Chacha, host of a podcast that's for folks who like learning about weird stuff. It's called, Well, That's Interesting. This is a comedy science-y show that tells the story behind the facts, and yeah, those stories are funny. It's the perfect way to learn and remember something, which is really useful now that we all have to make small talk again. Every week, I'll be joined with a guest who's coming in cold and learns everything in real time, just like you. Reactions are real, the facts are bizarre, and the laughter is plentiful. Listen to Well, That's Interesting wherever you do podcasts.
We're back. And I think it's time to dive back in. So on the night of... I know. On the night of Saturday, July 22nd, 1967, there was a party being held for two returning Black Vietnam veterans at an illegal nightclub above the Economy Printing Shop on the corner of 12th Street and Claremont, which is literally like 2.5 blocks from my house.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that where the marker is?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
These illegal nightclubs were really common in Detroit. They were called Blind Pigs for some reason. And they had been sort of like a feature in Detroit nightlife since Prohibition because white speakeasies wouldn't let in Black patrons. So Black people basically created their own speakeasies.
Yeah.
So on the night of the 22nd, around 10:30 p.m., a white sergeant and two Black officers showed up to Economy Printing dressed as basketball players, claiming to be basketball players from Cincinnati.
What?
And the door guy, they were trying to get into this party. They had to be undercover and they had to be like let in to be able to actually raid the building.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So they knocked on the door. The door guy opened the little window thing and was like, took one look at them and was like, nah, get the fuck out of here. No.
Come on now.
No.
Yeah.
So they left and they just decided to go on and try and raid some other blind pigs somewhere else in the city.
So were there no like bars for Black people in the 60s in Detroit?
There were. Yeah, there were. Okay. And there were a lot of bars on 12th Street, but the Blind Pigs could be open later because bars have to close at 2 here, but these could be sort of all night long. And they had gambling, which was illegal. Oh, okay. At the time. There's casinos here now, but at the time gambling was illegal. So they were really popular, especially as sort of like nightlife spots after the bars closed. People would go to
See. Okay. Like the after party.
Exactly. Yes. So as the night wore on, these cops continued to get turned away from Blind Pig after Blind Pig. They were just hopping around, getting turned away over and over. Yeah. So
they probably looked so off, you know? Like, yeah. Yeah. They had like a, I don't know.
How do you
like
do, fellow kids?
Totally. Yeah. That was their vibe.
Yeah.
They're looking like Jehovah's Witness. Like everything's all crisp.
Yeah.
Get the fuck out of here.
They had their moms iron their basketball uniforms before they went out.
Totally.
Yeah. So by 3:30 a.m. on Sunday morning, they decided to call it quits. They were like, okay, we give up. This is it. And they were on their way back to the precinct when they passed Economy Printing again and noticed 3 young women heading for the door. And one of the officers was like, hold up real quick. Let me try this one more time. He got out of the car and pretended to be with these three women going, yes. And in the 5 hours since they had been there before, the doorman had gotten really drunk.
Yeah.
So he was like, okay, cool. Come on in. Yeah. Waved them all through with a smile and the raid was on.
Yeah.
The problem was that this Blind Pig had been raided twice before and both times they had only arrested a handful of people. But this time they went upstairs and found there was a huge party going on. There were 82 people drinking and dancing and gambling. And it was almost 4 a.m. and they only had one paddy wagon.
I mean, not everyone's gambling at that point, right?
No. Not the whole party is gambling, but there's 82 people upstairs.
Okay.
And they were not expecting this many people and they had to arrest everyone. And this precinct only had one paddy
wagon. But is it illegal to drink after a certain point of time?
I mean, it's illegal to be in a Blind Pig because they're not legal. Yeah. I mean, it's illegal to be paying for drinks after 2 a.m., I guess, is the vibe. And everyone knew that these Blind Pigs were illegal. So, so they had one paddy wagon for their precinct that fit a max of 12 or 14 people. And they had 82 people to figure out how to get down to the precinct. So they called for help from neighboring precincts, but it was going to take a while. And outside on 12th Street, the lights of their police cruiser was beginning to draw a crowd. When the first paddy wagon arrived, a group of about 20 people was standing outside, mocking the cops, making jokes at their expense. But as the morning stretched on and they waited and waited for more paddy wagons to show up from other places, the crowd grew from 20 people to 50, and then 100, and then 200. Okay. And the energy of the crowd started to change. Jokes and mocking turned into anger and rage. One young guy started shouting, Black power, don't let them take our people away. Look at what they're doing to our people. Let's kill them, whitey motherfuckers. Let's get the bricks and bottles going.
I love that for them.
Yeah, absolutely. By 4:45 a.m., when the last wagon finally arrived, there were 250 angry people across the street, and they practically started stoning the cops with bottles and bricks. By the time they were finally leaving, the crowd was showering them with bricks and bottles. And
where's that guy from the riot after Milk died? Who like ripped up the street?
Yes, like, yeah, exactly.
We need the Hulk there as well.
Totally. Yeah. Throwing pieces of the street at them. Yeah.
Yeah, and they like I think they like moved wrought iron fences as well. I'm like, there's some serious grip strength happening.
I know
in absolutely. The gay community.
Yeah, they're all at the gym. It's fine.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah, they were in such a panic to get out of there because of so much stuff being thrown at them that two police cruisers almost hit each other as they were trying to speed off down the street, much to the delight of the crowd. They were like, fuck yeah, you assholes almost hit each other. And then just when it seemed like it was just about all over, someone picked up a bottle and decided to make one last throw. The whole crowd watched as this last bottle arced up into the sky, past a streetlight, and came down to crash right through the rear window of the last police car leaving the scene. Okay. Smashed through the car window, and the crowd went wild.
Yeah.
The Detroit uprising had officially begun.
Yeah, that's a good hand-eye coordination.
Right, I know, absolutely. Yeah.
Like they're like calculating the velocity. They're like, okay, they're going about 12 miles an hour.
The car's moving this fast. Yeah. Yeah. So at this point, the police were all gone. They were on their way back to the precinct, and this crowd kind of had nowhere to go. So they just started walking down 12th Street and they started smashing windows and breaking into shops. I mean, most of these shops were owned by Jewish store owners who treated them like shit. So they're like, fuck you.
Yeah, so and everyone's drunk at this point.
Exactly. Just, yeah. It's you know, almost 5 a.m. Yeah. They were probably all on their way back home after a night out, and they're like, fuck, you know, fuck all of this shit. This, you
yeah,
know,
they just arrested like 82 people just having a good time,
for
not
no
bothering
reason.
No one.
Yeah, they were there to celebrate two veterans coming back from Vietnam. Like,
yeah, they don't care about that shit.
Yeah. So they started breaking into shops. Basically, it sounded like a bunch of drunk white guys after a football game.
Totally. Yeah. It's like their team just won. And
yeah, exactly. Or lost. Either way.
Yeah. Either way, they're going to do destruction.
Yeah,
they're
exactly.
They're going to perform crimes.
Yes. Bart's joined a violence game.
A violence game. Oh, my God. I love that. Yeah, it's so crazy, like, just the way that, like, the same thing, if it was, like, white people would be framed. It's like,
they're
oh,
like,
they just...
No big deal.
Boys would be boys. They just...
Yeah.
Blowing off steam, yes. Blowing off steam. They didn't mean it. They got carried away. But, yeah, we will see how this is covered.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So... Looting started in a nearby drugstore, but it wasn't long before the whole street was teeming with looters. A symphony of burglar alarms added to the chaotic energy. And witnesses later described the atmosphere on 12th Street that morning as a carnival.
That sounds so fun, though.
I know. Seriously. Like, absolutely.
I wish I was there. I wish I was also just like helping, like, oh, let's get this store. Like,
yeah, I know.
It just sounds like it was the time. It was the place to
yes.
be until, you know, the cops started hunting us like animals. But like in this period of time, it seems very fun.
Yeah.
Like maybe it was playing music.
Yeah, I know. So the pastor of the Grace Episcopal Church on 12th Street, which is actually where I voted this year, reported that he saw, quote, a gleefulness in throwing stuff and getting stuff out of buildings.
He did see that look in their eye.
Yes. Yeah. A twinkle in their eyes. Yes. Yes.
Have you seen that? There's this guy, apparently a car goes off on his block every morning, like really, really early. And he is a musician and like put an amazing techno beat underneath
it. I did
it.
See that. Yes. Yeah. So good. Yeah.
It's so good. Well, yeah, we'll put it in on Instagram. It's real fun.
So between 8 a.m. and noon that morning, the crowd ballooned to almost 10,000 people.
Whoa.
Some were looters. Yeah. 10,000 people.
Wow. Oh my God. Yeah. Everyone's like, yo, call your cousin.
It's a carnival. Yeah, it's street fair. So some of the people were looters. Some were just there to watch and see what was going on.
Yeah,
and
some of them
were older residents who were actually trying to come out and stop it all, but it didn't fucking work at this point. It was,
go home, auntie. No.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That ship has sailed.
Yeah. Community figures from politicians to ministers and union leaders rushed down to 12th Street to try and reason with the crowd, but it was too late.
Yeah.
Inertia was running things at this point.
Yeah.
The mayor and the police commissioner decided to follow the same restraint that helped to calm down a much smaller uprising the summer before. Orders were that no looters were to be shot. in the hopes that they would.
That's so sad. I mean, that they have to say that. Like,
I mean,
don't go down there and kill everyone as we want to do, I guess.
It's a 93% white police force in a majority black and poor neighborhood. People were going to be shot if orders hadn't said otherwise. So they were hoping that the crowd would just blow off steam and they would eventually get tired and just go home. So much to the chagrin of this racist white police force, they just had to set up barricades and wait. Mm. But this time it was different than the uprising the year before. And the rebellion quickly spread to other parts of the city. The DPD was soon completely overwhelmed and found themselves being pelted with bricks and bottles and garbage everywhere they went. So that night, Sunday night, Mayor Kavanaugh enacted a citywide curfew and asked businesses to voluntarily close until things got under control. Then the next day, on Monday the 24th, Michigan's governor, George Romney, Mittens' dad, Mittens' dad was the governor of Michigan in the 60s.
Mittens' dad, he wanted to be president or something?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I'm going to be talking a little bit about him.
Okay.
I think.
In a mini? Okay. I know very little. I only know the gossipy things.
The only thing I know that I've read so far kind of relates to the uprising. So that's what my focus is going to be. But maybe I'll look more into this because maybe there's more
to it than that. Dad, I think it was his dad was a polygamist and like had moved to Mexico to some like polygamy colony. And like that's why he couldn't
know that.
That's why he couldn't be president because he was like technically born in Mexico, I believe.
Huh. I had no idea. Okay. That did not come up in my research.
Okay. All I know is the T.
I'll talk about this in the mini because I do want to talk about him.
And I'm like, am I lying? But yeah, go on.
Maybe you are. I'll tell everyone next week. If you are, I'll tell everyone next week.
Stay tuned to see if Stephanie lies.
Yeah, but so he called in the National Guard, but even their presence could not stop the uprising from spreading to other parts of the city. Hardy Drugs, which was only a couple of buildings away from Economy Printing, was one of the very first stores to be looted that morning. And once everything of value, Hardy Drugs,
Hardy Drugs, at first, it like took me a second to realize you were talking about a store. I'm just like, what kind of drugs? Hardy Drugs? I actually heard party drugs, and I'm like, party. Like ecstasy?
Amazing. Yeah. No, H-A-R-D-Y.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, okay.
Hardy, yeah. Mm. But yeah, so once everything of value was gone, one looter took out a lighter and was going to set the building on fire. And someone tried to stop him and said, no, man, people live upstairs.
Oh,
but he lit the building up anyways.
Damn.
And it's hard. Like, I know a lot of people are going to be like, oh, black people destroy their own neighborhoods and these blah, blah, blah. This was a commercial strip.
White people destroy their own capital.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. So. You tried to overthrow the government and you didn't like the results of an election.
I think.
Barbara.
Barbara. Oh, no.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, this was also like, these were not. Well, not at first anyways. These were not black owned businesses. They were just like, fuck these people. Fuck them. They treat us like shit.
Yeah.
Fuck it. But yeah, there were apartments above these businesses.
Yeah, they got swept up in that like fuck everything vibe.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. The energy was like more than anyone could do anything about at that point.
Yeah.
So a staggering 1,300 more fires would follow over the next 4 days.
Whoa.
1,300 fires in
crazy.
The city.
That's like many the Bronx of which, in the 70s.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Many of which under normal circumstances would have been considered multi-alarm fires, but they had to be fought by single engines because they were all happening all at once. And And the DFD was really underfunded at that point. So for some reason, on top of the fact that they didn't have enough fire engines for all of these fires, but yeah, so there were all these fires, but for some reason, the crowds started treating the firemen with the same anger and violence as they were treating the police. I think, like you were saying, it's just there's this energy in the air.
Energy,
it's bigger than contagious. Any one person. Yeah, exactly.
It's a mob at this point.
Exactly.
That they're moving as one and they're just like feeding on that energy.
Exactly. And there's so much anger. And these are young guys who are pissed off and unemployed and desperate. It makes complete sense. But I mean, it's really fucking unfortunate because of, people die because of this.
Yeah.
But the fire chief said, quote, "We couldn't fight the fires the way we wanted because my men were being harassed. Rioters were damaging trucks and cutting hoses, and snipers began firing at them. On 285 occasions, firemen were forced to leave the area because of threatening conditions. And fires in these commercial strips soon started spreading to residential areas because it was really windy that week, and the wind was just spreading these fires really quickly."
But like, and I don't know if you can even answer this, but like, are firemen like scared like the cops are scared?
There were literal snipers.
Oh, were there? Okay. Them. Okay. Because it's not people like they saw a hoodie and ran.
No. There were snipers trying to kill them. People were up on top of buildings, hiding behind windows. Like that the problem of the snipers kind of happened a little later in the next couple of days.
Where did they get sniper weapons though?
I mean, people had guns.
Like the cops, but anyways, yeah. Hopefully
people were
not
looting gun shops and pawn shops that had guns and stuff too.
Okay.
But I'm going to actually get into this, but a lot of the reports of snipers were exaggerated. There were snipers. There 100% were. They really were there, but there were not nearly as many as the cops tried to make out.
Yeah.
There was like a handful, and the cops tried to act like the whole city was shooting at them.
I feel like the snipers were the cops just because I know how they operate.
Well, that did happen. That did happen.
Yeah. But it's happened so many times in so many different cities.
I mean, they just heard gunfire, their own gunfire, and like, oh my God, it's a sniper. But there were actual snipers who, like, there was one up on top of the Henry
I believe Ford that there hospital. Were. Yeah. I believe that they were, but I think they were the cops.
Yeah. These commercial strips went up in flames first, but they soon spread to residential areas. The firemen had to sort of flee the scene. In some areas, residents organized rifle squads to protect the firefighters to try and save their homes from the fires and from the snipers that were up in the taller buildings. Black business owners tried to protect their shops by labeling their windows with phrases like "Soul Brother" to try and say like, this is a Black-owned business, but it didn't really seem to work. The energy and the anger of the crowd has reached a fever pitch. And many of the looters saw the wealthier Black Detroiters and business owners as part of the problem.
Yeah.
During the course of the 5 days of the rebellion, over 7,200 people were arrested. And many of them hadn't actually done anything wrong. They were just in the wrong place at the wrong time.
They fitted a curfew, you know?
Exactly, yeah. They were literally just like walking while Black or driving while Black.
Yeah.
Imagine that, yeah. Curfew violations were one of the most common offenses. Of those who were arrested, of the 7,200 people who were arrested, about 12% were female. About 20% were white. There was actually a lot of white people out that sort of like were like, yeah, fuck this shit. I'm going to join in. This looks like
chaos.
Fun. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Oh my God.
I mean, and a lot of these neighborhoods were still integrated neighborhoods, and the Black people were friends with, you know, there weren't, you know, a lot of, I mentioned this in the last episode that a lot of people had been sort of forced to move out to the suburbs because of redlining. Mm-hmm. But the people who are still here were like, these are my fucking friends. I'm joining in. Fuck this.
Yeah.
Yeah. So 20% of these looters were white.
Did you see that like birds aren't real protest that happened somewhat recently in New York?
No.
Oh, okay. It's like 1,000 white dudes came out. It's like a faux protest. Like they're, I don't know. It's outrageous. For why? Just because
you don't have anything to actually protest.
Yeah. So. They weren't coming to any of the BLM. They weren't protesting like the Iranian women. Apparently that just happened right before their protest. It was like an hour. They weren't there for that, but they came out for Birds Aren't Real. I'm like,
oh my God.
Everyone has their struggle. Uh-huh.
Do they? Straight white men.
Birds aren't real. They're surveilling us, yeah, don't you know?
I know. Yeah, so of those arrested, the youngest was 4 years old.
Stop this.
They arrested a four-year-old.
Stop it. Who? What?
I don't, yeah.
How does that even happen? They're booty cuffs. There's like,
I mean, seriously.
What is that? What?
Yeah.
Four is so young.
It's unbelievable. And the oldest was 82. They're arresting 82-year-old men and 4-year-old fucking babies in the street.
Okay, so they're just arresting like a woman at the grocery store with her kid.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I mean, I did read reports about like kids that were looting too. They were like, this looks like fun. I'm going to fucking wreck shit too.
You can't do shit at four.
You can't arrest a 4-year-old.
Yeah.
I mean, even if they're black. That's an adult in this country.
Yeah. If you're they're lucky they weren't shot.
Literally.
Because they shot an 8-year-old like in Ohio. Like, it's not okay. But four is, wow.
Unbelievable. Fucking
like,
unbelievable.
How stupid do you feel putting cuffs on a 4-year-old?
Literally. Yeah. Yeah. So because they arrested so many people so quickly, so it didn't take long for the city's jails to overflow and the police
their daycares.
I know. Yeah. The police started warehousing people in parking garages with no toilet facilities. And some people were forced to sit on buses for 30 hours with no food or water. Abuse was
legal.
I mean, they were just, they were backed up, so they couldn't finish booking people and et cetera. Reasons, et cetera.
Reasons.
Yeah.
Hashtag
abuse reasons. Was very common. And as mugshots would later prove, I know. As mugshots would later prove, many injuries happened after booking. I don't know how. They fell into my nightstick.
Clumsiness.
Yes, exactly. So by Wednesday, the 26th, 12 square miles of the city were on fire. At that point, Mayor Kavanaugh and the governor appealed to President Lyndon Johnson to send in federal troops. And he dispatched two brigades from the Army's airborne divisions. Tanks rumbled through the streets and buildings literally shook as terrified families huddled on the floors of their homes. Stripped mannequins and broken glass littered the street, and fires were raging everywhere.
Yeah.
The city felt like a war zone. It was the middle of a heat wave. It was humid. It was oppressively hot. And a strong wind was fanning the flames, causing fires to jump from building to building and covering the whole city with a thick, dense blanket of smoke. Along with the mechanical rumble of tanks, there was the constant sound of gunfire, police sirens, and fire trucks filling the air.
Scary.
People, literally, it was just fucking terror.
Oh God. I would I would be so scared. I don't know.
Yeah.
Just knowing that, like, the U.S. government will just kill you.
Literally. Like,
you don't need to do anything. They'll just kill you.
Yeah. People knew
they had to stay
away from their windows. Yeah. They're like, don't go in the window. Another clip here. This I actually took this from at the Detroit Historical Museum. They have this exhibit with some like firsthand interviews from people who were on the scene. But there's like kids in the background screaming. So sorry.
Amazing.
It's not a very good clip, but
I went back to the house and then it was all hell broke loose. I could feel my house start to shake and it was rumbling and then I realized it was tanks heading from one of the armories down Hamilton. That in itself was a very, very sobering moment.
Well, I think we felt safer, but what happened one particular night was my brother said, you have to look out the window, there's a tank out there. So I said, oh yeah, right, sure. You know, and I looked out the window and the tank turned around and pointed whatever that thing is at the window. My brother and I both just fell to the floor.
But yeah, so if you could hear that, a woman is talking about how when she was a little kid, her brother saw a tank outside their window and they ran to the window to look out. And then the tank, the top of the tank where the gun fires from, turned towards their window with the gun facing their window. And the kids just dropped to the floor.
My God, that's terrifying.
Yeah. Like the whole, yeah.
That's so scary.
So by this point, the looting was starting to recede. I mean, a lot of the shops had already been looted and there wasn't really much left to get, but things were starting to take a violent turn and snipers were starting to shoot at the police and military forces who were occupying their streets. They learned to stand back from the windows to eliminate the telltale muzzle flash that would sort of show where they were. And so it was really hard to tell where the firing was coming from. Mm. It was total chaos. And the police and the military started to think that any loud noise that they heard could be a sniper trying to kill them. Most of the time, they were wrong. Most of the time, it was not sniper fire. Yeah. So a Detroit newspaper reporter who spent one night riding in a command jeep reported that machine guns were being fired accidentally and streetlights were being shot out by rifles so that snipers couldn't see the police in
the
streets.
Okay, so how many snipers did they catch in the end? Like, I'm just curious.
I have that later on. Let's see.
Okay.
I think it was
you're going to get to it? Okay.
I think it was like 26 people were arrested for sniping, but some of them were white. And none of them were ever prosecuted. There was not any evidence, like enough evidence to ever.
Yeah, this whole sniping thing sounds really not.
The math ain't mathing for me.
Yeah.
There were real snipers. It was actually happening. There was at least one report of snipers in the upper floors of the Henry Ford Hospital.
I believe that there were snipers, but like I don't think that they were affiliated with the Black community or like
a lot of the people who were part of the actual community were saying that they thought that it was like, you know, radicals who were trying to escalate the situation and make things bigger to try and blow things up. Okay. I don't know. There's all sorts of speculation because nobody really knows what the fuck was going on.
But then none of them were charged like that.
I mean, a lot of them weren't caught. I don't know. It's like everything was just fucking chaos the whole time.
Yeah, you know? I believe that. Yeah, I believe that.
But they know that there were snipers in the upper floors of the hospital that were like shooting at police cars as injured people were showing up to the hospital. It was fucking nuts. Entire buildings were being placed under siege, even because of the sketchiest reports of sniping. The police were like, I'm searching this whole building because I heard there might be a sniper here.
Yo, I hear there's a four-year-old with a gun.
Exactly. Yeah, you know? Yeah.
He's in the hospital shooting people. We got to get him.
Yeah. As threats of snipers, real or imagined, spread... occupying forces got real jumpy and started making some deadly and tragic mistakes.
Let's pretend they're mistakes.
Yeah. Around midnight, a machine gunner in a tank who was spooked by the sound of nearby shooting saw a flash in a window of a nearby apartment on 12th and Euclid, and he opened fire. As the slugs ripped through the windows and walls of the apartment, 21-year-old Valerie Hood had her arm nearly severed at the shoulder. Her 4-year-old niece, Tanya Blanding, toppled dead as a .50-caliber bullet tore through her chest. The flash that the gunner saw in that window was not a sniper's muzzle flash, but rather 19-year-old Bill Hood lighting a cigarette. Around that same time, about a mile away, a group of young Black men and two white women were interrogated and tortured at the Algiers Motel on Woodward Ave over suspicion that there might be a sniper hiding in the motel. No weapon was ever found, and almost no evidence was ever found that anyone had fired from inside the motel. But three young Black men, Carl Cooper, Aubrey Pollard Jr. and Fred Temple, were murdered by the police that night in the motel. In 2017, a movie was made about the Detroit Rebellion, simply called Detroit, and much of it focuses on what happened at the Algiers Motel that night. It's a really fucking hard movie to watch. I watched it when I was researching this story, and it's really violent and really fucking hard to watch.
That is the story of this country. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, when you actually see what certain people have to experience regularly. It's horrifying.
Yeah.
Truly, yeah. Like the stuff of nightmares, because we tell ourselves we're such good people, you know? Like,
yeah. So police reported hundreds of sniper attacks in just a few days' time. But of the 7,200 people arrested during the rebellion, only 26 involved snipers. And not one person accused of sniping was successfully prosecuted.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Eventually, the fires started to die out and things began to calm down. And by Friday, July 28th, sufficient order had returned to the city and the troops began to pull out. On Tuesday, August 1st, the curfew was lifted and the National Guard moved out too. Over those 5 days in July, an estimated 10,000 people participated in the rebellion, with an estimated 100,000 gathering to watch. 2,500 businesses reported looting or damage, and almost 400 families were left homeless. Almost 1,200 people were injured, and 43 were dead. 33 of them were Black, and 10 of them were white. When newspapers published their names, the white names were listed first because they're more important.
Of course. They're people. And
yeah. It also listed their time of death, age, and address. And then the white people had their occupations listed, while the Black people had a description of what crime they were committing when the police murdered them.
Yeah.
Printed in the newspaper.
Because you got to justify. Those white deaths were tragic, but like the Black ones, they deserved it.
Yeah. One of the white people did have a crime listed instead of an occupation.
What?
Yeah.
Hmm. They must have been Irish or something. What? That shouldn't happen. Were they Italian? Were one of the Black Italians?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. He's Sicilian. Yeah.
Oh my God.
So yeah, as the fires finally went out and the smoke cleared, 12th Street was now little more than a 17-block ruin of jagged, fire-scarred walls, collapsed ceilings, bent steel girders, and flooded basements.
Oh my God.
Surveying the damage, Mayor Jerome Kavanaugh said, "Today we stand amidst the ashes of our hopes. We hoped against hope that what we had been doing was enough to prevent a riot. It was not enough."
Get the fuck out of here. Of course it wasn't enough.
Yeah, yeah. So the city removed the rubble and leveled the lots, but the businesses never came back to 12th Street. Yeah. The building that housed Economy Printing was torn down in the 70s. It was not destroyed during the rebellion, but they tore it down because of the power that it had, like as a symbol. And a park was built in its place. And eventually that historic marker was put up.
Okay.
Eventually, the city removed all of the remaining abandoned structures along 12th Street. They built affordable housing on one side and widened the street, put in the median, and renamed it Rosa Parks Boulevard.
I didn't know Rosa Parks was from Detroit.
She was not from Detroit, but she moved here. She like retired here.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I'm like, I thought she moved was here from the later. South. Okay.
Yeah, she was from Alabama, I want to say.
Yeah.
But yeah, she did. She moved here later in life. She and her husband lived in a house not far from here. Actually, after her husband died, the headquarters, corporate headquarters for Little Caesars is in Detroit, based in Detroit.
Okay.
And after Rosa Parks' husband died, she had trouble paying her rent. And the CEO of Little Caesars paid her rent until the day she died.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Rosa Parks shouldn't have to pay rent.
Exactly. I mean,
none of us should, but like she really should.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's awesome. I mean, their pizza's trash, but good for them. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, when we were poor, when I was a little kid.
Yeah. They did that. What? The $5. Scissors.
They still pizza, do right? it, which is.
No,
like,
they don't.
Yes.
No, they don't.
I don't know if it's $5 still.
But inflation. But
yeah. I know. Yeah. Ooh. Maybe it's $6 now. I don't know.
Stop
but,
it.
Yeah, they still cannot, have that.
It can't be $6. That it should be like
$17. I don't know how much it is, but yeah, if you stand on the you know empty street, it's a really wide. Like, there's not that many cars. There's no reason for it to be six lanes, three lanes in either direction. if you stand on this empty boulevard and look south from where I live or where this park is, where Economy Printing is or was, you can almost imagine this like bustling cityscape that used to be there, but it's just open fields.
I'm sure there's pictures of it, right?
Oh, like, yeah. Online. There's a ton of pictures. We'll be putting really them on Instagram. Yeah. I mean, it looked like Brooklyn. It looked like any sort of like shopping district in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. Really tightly packed brick buildings, two or three stories with shops on the bottom floor.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a ton of pictures we'll be putting on Instagram, though. Yeah, that's the story of the Detroit uprising in 67. The long hot summer of 67.
The long hot summer of 67. Was that just in Detroit, or was that like everywhere?
Oh no,
it was long and hot.
There was a heat wave. Like, it wasn't the whole country, but there was a heat wave across the country, like a major part of the country.
Yeah.
And these uprisings were happening in hundreds of cities across the country in 67. It was not just Detroit. Detroit was the biggest one that year by far. Mm-hmm. But like by the time it happened in Detroit, it had already been happening all over the country. That's why I was saying in the beginning, all these people were like, how do we stop this in Detroit? It's not going to happen in Detroit because we're so cool here. Don't worry.
Yeah, look
about
at our
it.
Mayor. Yeah, he wears his hat backwards.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. He can twerk.
Oh, no. He can't. He can't, y'all. Nope. Don't get your hopes up.
He moves his back.
He has a long back.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Jason had never heard long back before.
I don't know what that is. What is a long back? Is this like a...
Oh, my God. That smacks.
Yes. Is this my new smacks moment?
No, it's a very black thing. And I just assume like it had spread to white culture already. It means you have no butt. You just have a long back.
Oh, okay. Yes. Okay. Yeah. See, Russell has a long back.
Yeah.
I always just say that he has a concave butt.
Ooh, I love that. I love that you're getting like, what is that, geometry on him? Like you're going like angles.
It's isosceles. Yeah.
Oh my God, amazing. Yeah. Oh, amazing. So good. But yeah, thank you for sharing that story. It was a lot, but it was a really, I'm glad I know about this. I had no clue.
Yeah.
I had never once even heard reference to this event in Detroit or even this, you know, this long hot summer, because I guess this was not isolated. I had never heard of this. So thank you for sharing.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I didn't really get into this has been a long episode already and this is a long story. So I didn't really have time to get into what happened in Detroit after this, but afterwards, white flight was already happening and it was already happening in a big way. But after this, like everyone was just like, nope, goodbye. Okay. And basically that's when the city went from 30% white to what now it's 80% black, or 30% black back then. And now it's 80% black. And
it was only 30% back then.
Yeah. 30% black in 1967.
Oh, so this was the turn.
This was it. This changed the history of Detroit. Literally, in 5 days, the entire city was reshaped overnight.
Jesus. Wow. Yeah, it just sounds like such a chaotic situation. And I get why it's so hard to make sense of what even happened, because it was everything happened. And it's hard to, really understand like all of, because there were just so many people involved. In just so much chaos and like the people feeding off just the lawlessness of it all.
Totally. It was this energy and inertia that like was bigger than any one person. And like it was unstoppable.
Yeah. I like really want to look into this further just for my own, like I'm still hung up on these snipers. I'm going to do a deep dive because I don't get it. It seems off.
Everything that I read said that all of the reports of snipers were exaggerated.
But they were there. But like they were there, and yet they didn't arrest any. I don't know. It's really odd.
I know.
Because it's like this is the thing you are all afraid of, yet you're not going to arrest any of them.
Yeah, I mean, they did arrest 26 people, but they didn't have evidence.
Sniping.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
They arrested 26 people. No one was prosecuted though. But I think that they didn't have the evidence. I guess I don't know if people were just like getting rid of their weapons before the police showed up or whatever.
Evidence has never been a problem for the cops, though.
I don't know.
It's not the
burden of the cops to convict people or prosecute people. You know what I mean?
No, but DAs work with the cops.
Yeah. I don't know. All I know was like the cops acted like there were thousands of snipers.
Of course, not
at all.
Yeah. What an event. Whoa. So much. Yeah. But yeah, thank you for sharing that story. I think you've given us all a lot. This story was a lot. Yeah. And thank you for doing all the research. Like, I know that it was not easy at all.
I've been researching the story for months, honestly.
Yeah.
I went to the Detroit Historical Museum has an amazing exhibit specifically about this event.
Okay.
I went through the whole museum. The whole museum is great, but like this, it's really cool the way they have it set up. It's like there's all this audio footage playing of firsthand witness accounts and
eyewitness.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, my drink has long been empty.
Yes, mine is too. And the whiskey that I went and got after is also empty at this point.
Yeah, same. I just have some ice, but yeah, we're done.
We're done. That's it.
America's history is juicy. We just add a whole bunch of weird shit, man. This one was such an odd creme de cacao. We had some Galliano and cream.
Heavy
but
cream.
It was not bad. But
no, it was not as gross as
was it great? No.
I mean, we'll see when the evidence comes in. I don't know if there's enough evidence if we'll ever know if it was great or not.
It's possible. Yeah. The world may never know if it was great or not. But we survived. And that's all that matters.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for listening to Beyond Reproach. This has been Stephanie Domingo.
And Tuxel Erzl.
Thank you to our new audio editor, Dev. We could not do this without him.
Absolutely not.
No.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Beyond Reproach. Please note we are not historians. We are just a couple of drunks who never shut up and love history. A full list of all source information can be found in the show notes on our website. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe. Written reviews are especially important. If you like us, please do one of two things. Leave us a written review on Apple Podcasts or send this episode to a friend, family member, or someone who you think would be into it. Don't forget to follow us on social media. And make sure you follow us on Instagram because we post our cocktail recipes the Thursday before each full episode. Please drink along with us if you're not driving. We also have a shop on beyondreproachpod.com. Get your merch, brand yourselves. We also have exclusive content on Patreon where you can directly support the production of our show.